Middle East Studies at Marine Corps University presents the Iranian Challenge from U.S. and Israel Perspectives by Dr. Anthony H. Quartersman, Center for Strategic and International Studies. This is the third lecture in a series being hosted by MES at MCU entitled Framing the Iranian Challenge. Dr. Quartersman holds the Arleigh A. Burke Chair in Strategy at CSIS. He is also a National Security Analyst for ABC News. Dr. Quartersman is a recipient of the Department of Defense Distinguished Service Medal. He has led numerous studies on national missile defense, asymmetric warfare and weapons mass destruction, critical infrastructure protection, U.S. security policy, energy policy, and Middle East policy. Dr. Quartersman formerly served as National Security Assistant to Senator John McCain of the Senate Armed Services Committee. He has held numerous foreign assignments, including posts in Lebanon, Egypt, and Iran, and has worked extensively in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf. Most recent publications include Iranian Weapons of Mass Destruction, The Birth of Regional Nuclear Arms Race with Adam C. Seitz, and Saudi Arabia, National Security in a Troubled Region. This lecture took place Wednesday, 15 December 2010, 1400-1530, Breckenridge Hall, Quantico, Virginia.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the third in the series of lectures framing the Iranian challenge, which the Middle East Studies at Marine Corps University has put forth. Those of you who've been to the first two, I think you will be very, very well enriched with Dr. Quartersman. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. General Neller, General Murray, welcome. I will not introduce Dr. Quartersman because Adam Seitz, who has behind the scenes done most of the work that gets us the attention and the traction that we have had in the year, is here. And I found Adam through the grace of Dr. Quartersman. We were both early risers in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates Armed Forces Club. And there we were in a huge, beautiful building. And we were looking for somebody to come and join the, at the time, a one-man show called Middle East Studies. I said, you know, I'm looking for somebody good who can do this, this, and that. He said, I have the man for you. He lives in Colorado. And you can get him and you won't be disappointed. So we thank you for introducing Adam Seitz to us. And please, Adam, introduce your former boss.
Good afternoon, everyone. As Dr. Carden said, I've come to Marine Corps University through Dr. Quartersman. He's a great man. He's a great mentor to me. But most of you probably already know, Dr. Quartersman is a very well-respected man in the field. He's the Burke Chair at CSIS. Center for Strategic International Studies in Washington, D.C. He was a part of General McChrystal's advisory team on the Afghan strategy. He published numerous reports on Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, and the Middle East. And latest publications on the issues are Saudi Arabia, national security in a troubled region, and Iranian weapons of mass destruction, Birth of Regional Nuclear Arms Race, which I co-authored with Dr. Quartersman. I thank Dr. Quartersman for coming today and for being a good mentor to me. But without further ado, I'd like to present Dr. Quartersman.
Thank you very much, Alan. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is the subject which I think I found extraordinarily difficult to try to summarize. The reason is that we are talking about not simply where we are today, but where we could go over a period potentially of decades. We are not talking about one simple set of perceptions where we can be certain that any action we take removes the problem. And a great deal of discussion that does take place in this issue tends to be political. It tends to assume that countries have a single view. It tends to minimize uncertainty, and it tends to focus on politics and arms control, and not on the military dimension and the military risks of the choices that we are going to have to make. Now, there is no U.S. or Israeli perspective. There is a mix of perspectives, and they interact. This is interesting. See if we can get it to work. Okay. They interact with different views because we do not have the same interests exactly, nor do we have the same perceptions. There are people who really see Iran as a massive threat. There are people who see Iran as being on the edge of political collapse and having a reform regime. There are people who see Iran as the victim of U.S. mistakes. There are people who assess this type of operation, if we would carry out preventive strikes, as easy and decisive. People who see it as extraordinarily risky. People who have all kinds of different assumptions about Iranian capabilities and our capabilities, often based on, shall we say, limited empirical experience. We basically, however, when we look at the dome, focus on one key strategic interest. And that interest is essentially the continued flow of energy to an increasingly global economy. For Israel, this is on the one hand an immediate threat to regular warfare, political leverage in the form of Lebanon, Iranian ties in Syria, but more than that, it is an existential threat. It is a question very much of national survival. To the Gulf, while it may potentially be a war that could affect national survival, most people in the Gulf, particularly at the level of heads of state and senior officials, are much more worried about how Iran could come to dominate the region, intimidate them, gain influence, expand its role, and become the major power in the Gulf, while at the same time affecting both their ability to export energy and their ability to operate national economies. Now, we do not, as a country, do a particularly good job of admitting our energy dependence. It's rather odd that when we talk politics, we talk about energy independence. When we actually do official projections, we show just the opposite. These numbers are taken from the Department of Energy. They make extraordinarily favorable assumptions about conservation, efficiency, and alternative supply. And the fact is that what they show is we will be just as dependent directly on energy imports through 2035 as we are today. What they don't show in this kind of graph is that dependence is only part of the story. None of the numbers we use on imports reflect the fact this country imports massive amounts of heavy industrial and manufactured goods from Asia, which gets its energy from guess where, almost exclusively the Gulf. It does not really reflect the fact that, on an average, we increase our dependence on global trade by about 0.3 to 0.5% a year, which would not by itself be significant in any one year, but means that we will become dependent on the status of the global economy in a steadily growing form. Does not reflect the fact that this interacts with the emergence of China, which is increasingly dependent on Gulf exports. The United States has critical strategic interests tied to energy. We have friends, we have allies, we have reasons to protect friendly states. But this is the core strategic interest. And I think for those of you who occasionally hear about energy independence, as someone who went with Secretary Schlesinger to the Department of Energy, you may have forgotten that President Nixon promised us full energy independence by 1980. And the reality is that after something like 35 years of energy exploration, trying to find energy outside the Middle East, its share as a percentage of conventional oil reserves is significantly higher than it was when all of this search for alternative sources began. And that again is reflected in the projections of the Department of Energy. Now, from Israel's viewpoint, there is a fundamental disconnect. This is downtown Tel Aviv. And I find increasingly, as time goes on, fewer and fewer military officers and civilians have any idea of what a nuclear exchange physically means. People don't teach nuclear weapons effects or nuclear targeting or simulate nuclear exchanges. But that is the direct pressure that would happen of one very low-yield fission weapon on downtown Tel Aviv. This is the potential effect of a worst-case fallout in terms of covering the coastline. But if I move that in the prevailing winds, it covers a far larger part of the population. And the long-term death rate from fallout, this really extends roughly 30 years into the future. It affects life expectancy that long on the affected population. I won't walk you through the details of this slide, but this gives a very tangible picture of what downtown Tel Aviv actually looks like. This isn't abstract. This is people. And it is the people that have been through multiple wars, who know what direct threats to their territory are, and who have been through the experience of the Holocaust. Now differences do not mean we have radically different views of what to do about Iran. But it is extremely dangerous to assume that the perspectives are identical. They aren't. They're based on fundamentally different views of risk and history and vulnerability. Within the Gulf, and again I won't walk you through death by PowerPoint, we'll leave this presentation for you, for those of you who are interested, and I will skim through the details. But I find again and again there is a tendency to oversimplify, to minimize the issues, to try to simplify a situation which can only be understood if you actually treat uncertainty and complexity in detail. But what we have seen over the period since the ceasefire of the Iran-Iraq War, particularly since 1992, is a steady buildup in Iranian capabilities for asymmetric warfare. And that buildup has accelerated significantly in the last 4 years. It now occupies posts and capabilities throughout Iran's coastline, from essentially Iraq and Kuwait through the Straits of Hormuz into the Gulf of Oman. It is a threat expanded in terms of swarming capability with simple low-cost systems, but more than that, it is a threat steadily expanded by increases in the range of anti-ship missiles, both sea and land-based, and targeting capabilities in smart mines, in submarine warfare, and a host of other tools which Iran can use. And if you are in the Gulf, important as the nuclear threat and missile threat are, this is a much more immediate capability, which can be used in very limited ways. Now, there are a lot of different ways to see this balance, and I will only take you through a few. But one thing that we have to understand from a Gulf perspective, and an Iraqi perspective, and a Turkish perspective, is one of the key impacts of the Iraq War. in 1992, regardless of the damage we had done in 1991, Iran emerged as still significantly weaker than Iraq. In 2003, when you look at this, Iraq is the red bar and Iran is the blue bar. Today, basically, aside from a handful of T-72 tanks and M1s on order, which are the only modern major weapon system now in delivery to Iraqi land forces, this is the change in the balance. The air numbers aren't striking because you're comparing tanks to aircraft. But the fact is, Iraq has no major combat aircraft, and Iran, for all of its limits, has significant numbers. We removed, in the process of the Iraq War, a key counterbalance to Iranian power. We changed the military balance in the region in ways which every state in this area sees as deeply destabilized. And it is all too easy to forget that set of perceptions, because that is not something we naturally focus on. This is the target base as perceived by Gulf states. Those dark spots are oil fields, the red spots are gas fields. Those lines show the national waters of each state, and really around virtually all of those spots offshore are offshore targets. Areas that can be attacked without being in the Strait of Hormuz, where a small craft and a small target can do large-scale damage. And this is not a theory. In the Iran-Iraq War, a very small Iranian party of Iranians seized the Iraqi offshore terminals and brought an end to Iraq's export capabilities in the course of about a 30-hour operation. This is compounded by the fact that countries can be attacked and intimidated, that the facilities they have are often very small, like this Ras Tanura, but absolutely critical to world supply. One facility can have a massive impact on the world economy and on exports. People focus far too much on the Strait of Hormuz. The threat is real there, but low-level attacks, attacks strung out over time, all can have a major impact on the Gulf states. And what is equally critical is the fact there are no alternatives. Yes, there are pipelines that can bypass the Gulf, but every one of these pipelines either doesn't work or is fully used. There's no surplus capacity to the actual ability to transit out of the Gulf in Iranian areas. I should note that Iran, too, is vulnerable. This is a game where deterrence, intimidation, limited all are absolutely critical if Iran can find a convincing way to use it without having the fear of retaliation and counter-escalation. I should also note here that this is one of the most vulnerable target sets in the world in other ways. And this could be both nuclear and conventional. People talk increasingly of weapons of mass effect rather than mass destruction, because precision weapons on the right target can have a critical impact. This is an overhead photo of a desalination. It takes three strikes to basically knock targets out that have an 18-month lead time for replacement. There is no alternative source of water production or power. There's no grid that affects water in this region. If this goes down, there is no physical way that you can move water in quickly and efficiently to substitute for the loss of this facility. And this is not literature that Iran has ignored. You can find that Iran is very well aware of this. And this photo, while it is not provided by an authoritative source like WikiLeaks, is available on Google, and it is available in far more detail from commercial overhead. Now, Iran's perspective has to be brought into this too. We are talking about U.S. Israeli and Gulf perspectives. But Iran has been through the Iran-Iraq War. It has been the target of missile and chemical weapons. It has had U.S. raids in the past. It has fought a tanker war with the United States. It sees itself under threat from the United States. It sees itself as a Shiite state under threat from extremist Sunni movements. And it has its own ambitions and history of regional influence and power. The difficulty for Iran, and I won't walk you through all of these examples, is a simple one. I cited the expansion of their capability for irregular warfare. What they have not had, in any significant sense, is the ability to modernize conventional forces. Since 1988, where they lost roughly 40% of their land force inventory in 6 weeks of campaign, a lot of which emerged in parking lots outside Baghdad. There has been almost no major military modernization. And much of the equipment, frankly, was there when I was in Iran as an assistant to Ambassador Helms in the early 70s. If you look at the numbers in terms of modern weapons, as distinguished from the old inventory, the best I could do for Iran by way of modern tanks is the T-72. Any of you who saw the vulnerability of the T-72 in the Gulf War, particularly export version, realize this is not really a modern tank. And if you look at Saudi holdings of M60s and M1s, one Southern Gulf power has larger inventories of conventional weapons. Iran's air order of battle looks good in terms of basing, and raw numbers aren't that bad unless you realize that most of the Gulf air forces can actually fly their air force, but Iran can only actually fly about 40 to 60% for more than token sorties for demonstration purposes. And in terms of modernization, again, there are virtually no modern aircraft. The range of Iran's power is very impressive on these sort of James-type maps, but the fact is, when you are flying against a force which mixes U.S. assets with Saudi, UAE, and other first-line U.S. aircraft, when you are flying old P-3s against modern AWACS, when you have a screen of modern surface-to-air missiles that you're flying into and none of your own, the reality is very different. And most of Iran's inventory of surface-to-air missiles, with the exception of one system, the Tor-M, is essentially Vietnam-era technology. Systems that we broke, essentially electronically, something like 25 years ago, are still the main systems. And the modifications have been limited and are of uncertain effectiveness. Now, yes, Iran makes various claims, but this is the reality. From Iran's perspective, if you wish to be able to use irregular assets, you need some way of deterring conventional strikes. And to do that, one means is to have nuclear weapons and missile forces and create a threat which, no matter how improbable it may be, is so serious that the willingness to take major risks against Iran in the face of deployed Iranian nuclear forces is limited. And that is very clear from Iranian actions and literature as a key motive. Now, part of this is the third point down. There is a tendency in Israel, and it is taken quite seriously within the IDF and at the policy level, to take everything Iran says about Israel seriously. The fact is, however, that that almost certainly is far more political than real. If you want to carry out a selective military buildup to deal with Arab and Gulf states, and you do not want opposition, if you want to carry out proxy operations in Lebanon, if you want ties to Syria, if you want to influence groups like Hamas, your rhetoric will be directed constantly against Israel. It gains you support on the Arab street, and it creates major problems in terms of what is perceived publicly, or said publicly by leaders in the Arab world. So one has to be very careful. Iran may unleash forces in Israel that go far beyond what it expects, but it is far from clear that while Iran certainly does, at the leadership level, oppose Israel's existence, that this is the real reason for many of the actions Iran has taken. This just, again, gives you some rough picture. Remember what I said about asymmetric warfare? One thing that truly bothers me about a lot of the U.S. assessments I see is they are focused on military and security forces. Let me just say to you, any assessment that is a conventional military balance in this region and does not address this is analytic rubbish. These countries do not operate and think in those terms. This is not a force structure oriented for conventional warfare. They are not going to fight you on terms that are typical of the wars of the past. They're going to be a far more adaptive version of the form of warfare we've seen in Afghanistan and then Iraq. We also have to understand how broad this problem is. When you talk about Israel and the Gulf states and the Arab world, remember how many places Iran is now actually active. The whole idea of Iran having active ties to Venezuela is something that even a few years ago would have been almost unimaginable. And yet that interacts with transfer from systems like the SA-24 to Venezuela. And when you look across this, as you may have seen in the Times today, it moves in a very different way to North Korea. And that indeed is one of the things that makes it almost impossible for us to estimate with any unclassified data the progress they're making in missile or nuclear terms. We simply have no way to know the level of transfer that has gone to Iran from North Korea. We do know several things. They have shipped old missile systems in the past. We know there have been Iranian observers at North Korean missile tests. We know that Iran acquired at least part of a nuclear weapons design from the AQCOM network, which was a North Korean copy of Chinese weapons designs. All of this is a matter of public record. But how much they got, exactly how far they've been able to build on it, is extraordinarily speculative. Again, I will leave this behind, but when we talk about the Gulf, you do have to link what happens there to their missile and their nuclear efforts. And this is the island that they acquired from United Arab Emirates. This is an island, Abu Musa. I was on Abu Musa, well, now some 40 years ago. It was nothing. Today, if you look at it, the major characteristic of Abu Musa is two things. It is an airstrip, which is a major airfield, and it is a ring road which connects underground, sheltered, and a host of potential facilities and basic areas. again, you can see this on Iranian islands throughout the Gulf region. Now let me just walk through a couple of key issues here. You can pretty well disregard any unclassified estimate that says they can project where Iran is in terms of nuclear weapons. We already have all the technological components. What we do not know is their ability to translate that technology into actual integrated weapons capability. Some of you may have heard that any physics student can design a nuclear weapon. That's perfectly true. Any physics student can design a time machine or a vehicle for interstellar travel. The fact is, this remains the absolute limit for what you can do in technology. It's exemplified by the fact that the three countries that are the most recent members of the nuclear club, North Korea, Pakistan, and India, have all lied about the yield of every nuclear test they've conducted. They have exaggerated their progress and their capability. We also, frankly, cannot predict where Iran stands in terms of nuclear enrichment capability. You may have seen today an article, well, North Korea showed one American scientist a centrifuge facility, and therefore on the basis of that scientist, North Korea has to be more advanced than the Iranians. You may need somewhat more reliable reports. You have estimates of capability, but they're all based essentially on the P-1 centrifuge, which dates back 35 years. We know physically they're working on at least four more types. In theory, they will be put into the times. But we have no idea how far they've gotten or where they are. And that is typical. The same is true of missiles. I find, again, that with people who have not had to grow up with this, there is an amazing faith in intelligence estimates of missile performance. First, most of the time what is called is circular error of probability. That is defined as a system where technically the missile works perfectly through the guidance phase with perfect targeting. Half of the time. It does not measure where the other 50% go. It does not measure reliability. When you put nuclear weapons on a missile, you might want to know where the other 50% go. You have people perpetually quoting a nominal weight of 1,000 kilograms. But there is almost zero probability that if Iran has a nuclear weapon, it will weigh exactly 1,000 kilograms. Which means that all of the range data you see are not only nominal, but guesstimates. And this is based on missiles which are in the design phase. Virtually all of Iran's tests do not go to term. In fact, they're exploded before they go to their actual point of destination. And Iran has only tested two long-range missiles in the same configuration twice. I say this because, like the nuclear side, when somebody says intelligence knows or we know, there is no physical way. So you see testing on a far different level that you would have enough indicators at any level of classification to be able to predict where you really are and your rate of progress. You also basically do not know how far they can get and when they can get, not only at nuclear warheads, but more effective conventional warheads. Iran is a declared chemical weapons power. We don't know about biology. We do not know exactly where they stand in terms of guidance technology. And this is absolutely critical. because a missile with simply strapped down inertial guidance is a weapon you can use against a city, but with a 1,000 kilogram warhead, which produces about one third the effectiveness of a conventional bomb because it directs the blast upwards, your chance of actually hitting anything, even in something as large as an airfield or a major energy complex, and doing critical damage is almost negligible. You have to go to terminal guidance for a conventional warhead to have an impact. Just think for a moment of what I have just said in terms of U.S. and Israeli perceptions. We don't know where they are in weapons production. We don't know where they are in weapons design. We know they still have problems in basic missile technology, but we do not know where they are going or how fast they are going to get there. Are we 3, 5, 10, or 15 years away? And we are talking here warfighting, not the possession of one nuclear device. Exactly why it is important in military terms to know when they could get one nuclear device versus a deployed force is a question people should start asking themselves far more seriously. A bomb in the basement or a bomb in an underground test is not a force capability. In terms of scenarios, we have no idea how they would plan to use this, or even if they would develop effective plans. Do they plan to go to breakout? Do they plan to go to deploy? Do you want to use this as a threat, to intimidate, to deter? Will they carry out the improvements and deployment necessary to be effective? And again, we can't relate what they might do to what Israel is doing. We have talked about extended regional deterrence, but we aren't doing it. We haven't decided yet whether we would deploy a kind of tactical nuclear deterrent. The Gulf is moving toward missile defense, but it isn't there. The Saudis have partially modernized the Chinese missile, but it's not much more effective than the Iranian system. All this is in transition, and in no case here can you say we now know where they're going and when they're going to get there. And the moment you start thinking in warfighting terms versus possession of one nuclear weapon, those uncertainties become critical. Now let me just also note here a few other realities. Remember what I said about all of this data? You know, it's all over the place. We have colored graphs out the kazoo. There was a time when people would ask nasty questions about where data came from. I hope that time hasn't passed. Who would you trust to provide you with reliable estimates on the basis of the data we have today? And if you don't know, what do? Do you preempt? Do you prevent? Do you wait? You claim you know, you claim that we should carry out the strikes for Israel. Ehud Barak is rather liberally quoted in WikiLeaks, excuse me for quoting them, as saying that we should attack. But there's no explanation of the timing or his perceptions there. And we look down this long list of data, and you can look at it later, and the problem is this. For all this rhetoric, for all the data, we don't even know whether this system actually exists. Did they get it? Maybe the intelligence community does know. But reporting it as James and going into all this immense data that you see on the bottom is very easy if nobody asks you where you got it. Quite aside from the fact there'll be an exam afterwards as to what hypergolic means, we have the problem that nobody knows whether any of this is relevant. We don't know whether they'll improve missiles or whether they can reverse engineer this. They did test a new system this year, and they're clearly moving towards solid fuel. But we have no estimates of how quickly they can get there or how their guidance systems are improving. And one of the problems you have here is the further you go, the harder the problems are in terms of reliability, accuracy of guidance, and warhead design. And let's say you have 8 nuclear weapons. Let's say you have limited nuclear testing. What do you do? What risk do you take? Put the weapon on a missile, which you will have to fire on an Earth that is not round and subject to all kinds of anomalies outside your territory for the first time in history. Unless we see that test conducted very visibly. So anybody can draw a circle. You can get a very good contract career doing it. But drawing circles doesn't make it real. Let me just very quickly note, from Israel's viewpoint, they already have the elements of missile defense. As we look down the list here, they also have created a level of integrated defense we have just begun to talk about in the Gulf, and for which there are currently no plans. Iran has looked at it in terms of the S-300, but has no capabilities. So Israeli perceptions are based on something that other perceptions aren't. Both effective missile defense and effective air defense. And that takes us down, and I'm going to skip ahead here, leaving you briefly, to dealing with some realities. If you read through a lot of the literature here, these are the target base that people point to. Only one facility in this entire area actually is hardened. That's Natanz. If this is the target base, obviously Israel can carry out the strikes at whatever cost, because it will have to penetrate Iranian air defenses. The problem is that these sort of simple diagrams in the IISS, or Department of Defense, don't always tell much of the story. Remember what I said about hardened facilities? That's what the top of Natanz looks like today. This is what went into it. It's a little more than the entrance to a parking garage in any downtown building. That's what it looks like from the street. The problem practically is it is essentially an area that can hold 30,000 centrifuges underground, excavated over 4 years using hardened underground facilities. Do we know whether Israel could take that facility out? No. Do we know whether we could do it? Probably. But we have never released the full nature of the advances we've made in hard target strike capability. Where we know Israel's limits are very simple. There's only so much an F-15 can carry. And this is, to some extent, a matter of weight. But that's only part of the story. What we also don't know is how many other underground facilities they have. We do know they have. This is the facility at home. This is a facility we discovered this year. Now, this is impressive because we can associate it with a nuclear activity. But there are something like 200 to 300 tunnel facilities in Iran for other purposes, and about half of those, potentially, could store a small modern centrifuge facility. Looking at the facility at Ararat, which is a potential plutonium source, it is more vulnerable. But you can put those reactors also in a tunnel. And remember the amount of warning we had that Syria had North Korean construction of a reactor. And That was a surface facility, so it was easier to detect. Looking at the broader side, this is an unclassified map of the full range of nuclear facilities, and our problem is this. Assuming we took out Natanz, which is the facility we know, assuming we could essentially collapse home, which because it's in a mountainside, not underground, is a different target base, we have absolutely no idea how many of these facilities could be used for centrifuge facility production or dispersion. The intelligence community may. I'm talking when I say we, unclassified analysts and what people can say at any normal level of classification. I can also tell you that we have very good unclassified evidence this map understates the problem. Because from Israel's viewpoint, we know some of those centrifuge facilities are actually in the far northwest corner of Iran. That is almost certainly not coincidental. You put them there because it is the furthest possible distance from Israel, it's the hardest penetration, and it is at their level of refueling a problem of maximum risk. This got out of sequence, but remember what I said about Natanz, and I said about those 30,000 centrifuges and two underground facilities. The building you saw was that small rectangle. The underground cavities are the larger ones, and note, there are three major compartments here. You have to collapse three facilities, not just one, and you have to collapse chambered facilities within those. That is not a simple military task. The other problem we get into here is, are we going to knock out the nuclear systems without knocking out the missile systems? And here again, there's a fundamental difference in perception. Let me close with that and throw this open to questions. I note that in the other parts of this briefing, I do go into the physical nature of how Israel can conduct a strike, the limits on its air force and its strength. And I talk about the implications of a nuclear arms race between Israel and Iran. That's speculative. At least on the Iranian side. We already know that Israel looked at this problem years ago. In part, in cooperation with South Africa, it developed much longer range boosters and deployed them on what is sometimes called the Jericho 3 system. It has the capability to launch nuclear weapons against virtually any target in this region. It has a massive advantage over Iran in that its access to the French testing and weapons development program gave it full design data on further nuclear weapons. That is a fundamental difference in warfighting capability. And it makes Iran extremely vulnerable to counterstrikes. Not as existentially vulnerable as Israel, perhaps, but as vulnerable in many ways to an attack on the Persian population of Iran and its cities. And something like 60% of the urban population of Iran is essentially existential in most national terms. So why this? Let's say for a moment this is not Israel. Let's say it's the United States using facilities in Diego Garcia, land bases in the Gulf, and carrier aircraft. It's using stealth, precision weapons, and all of our intelligence assets. We could essentially hit what is roughly 164 nuclear and missile targets in spite of the uncertainty in characterizing, As most of you know, that would involve multiple strikes on many of those targets. So quite aside from the fighter escort problem, we're talking something on the order of about 600 precision strikes with aircraft or cruise missiles to get to a reasonable probability of total suppression. A fraction of that could get to the major known facilities. After that, we, unlike Israel, could take time to do battle damage assessment. Remember our track record here. Every piece of data we issued on striking at Iraqi facilities in 1991 was wrong. The one major facility we hit was a diversionary strike where we found out about the Calutrons by accident. The Air Force studies and analysis estimate made 3 years later showed exactly what I said. We got rid of their facilities through inspection. We attempted to carry out another series of strikes in an operation most people have forgotten called Desert Fox. The reality is that Desert Fox was cited as damaging one major missile facility. But if you look at the battle damage assessment data later, it was irrelevant. It had almost no meaningful impact, and we mischaracterized more than half the targets in Desert Fox. The ability to assess is critical, and then we come to the ability to restrike, which requires us to not only take the time for damage assessment, but restrike and then essentially conduct, as we did in Iraq, a period of constant suppression so Iran will not take the risk of recovery and rebuilding. And that is another fundamental difference between us and Israel. And it is another critical issue in terms of Gulf perceptions, because it requires us to be there for an unstated period of time until we can be certain we have an Iranian regime which would not attempt to covertly rebuild a nuclear production facility and would not shift from overt missile delivery to more covert means. This is not simple. I hope I've given you a picture of the uncertainty as to time and capability. I hope I've given you a difference in terms of fundamental warfighting perceptions and capabilities. Because what I have seen in far too much of the literature is either a focus on arms control or the idea you go in and do this once, it's simple, and it's over. And about the only thing I can be certain of is, as long as you have this Iranian government, it won't be once, it won't be simple, and it won't be over. Thank you very much.
The floor is open. We have about half an hour for Q&A. Please introduce yourself and ask your questions. Dr. Paul.
Sir, Captain John Welch, I go to the... So I want to ask you about the last comments you made there. What do you see as far as looking ahead, the stability of the country with the young populace, the discontent with the outcome of the elections, and the future of that?
Well, we have almost the same public industry in predicting reform in Iran we had in Iraq. That'd be extremely careful, because a lot of the people who are talking about how fragile the Iranian regime is are the ones who promised us that if we went into Iraq, Saddam's regime would fall, we'd have instant success, democracy would blossom, and we'd transform the region. I think once is enough. Having been in Iran and knowing what I've seen to date, it's not that the Green Revolution is unimportant, but it is far, far narrower than any of the issues that dealt with the Shah. It was far less deterrent. It was confined roughly to upper middle class and student areas. And then in two urban areas, and most of it in Tehran, in the more liberal schools. That's not a serious power struggle. There's no analysis which really even attempts to provide accurate crowd counts. And I have to go back to Washington and say that I have 2,500 Marines come out to hear me this afternoon. Unless somebody actually looks at the photo of the audience, nobody is going to contradict it, unfortunately. And that's what's happened in Iran. People are making statements that are not based on any empirical analysis. And believe me, the day may come when a regime is tweeted to death. But don't hold your breath. It is just not that serious. The problem, I think, at this point is that over time our sanctions may take hold. The economic pressure may convince conservatives in this regime. It may give the opponents to kind of get a job if those opponents are sincere. But so far, the end result of the election has been a massive increase in the power of the president, a steady rise in the power of either active or past members of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, the ability to mobilize the Bunyads on a far more sophisticated level to control dissent than we've seen in the past, a crackdown in the court system, in the media, and in academic disciplines. And at this point in time, the power struggle, where it is conservative versus conservative in the upper echelons of the regime, that is a major area of controversy, and not any element or evidence as yet of a popular revolution or serious unrest. You know, it's nice to believe, it's nice to hope, but you need evidence and indicators.
Please.
So, Matt, the interplay between the IRGC and the Marine Army, how does that work with the nuclear issue? And if the Iranian were to develop a nuclear weapon, who do you think would be, in control of it? How does that relate with the
input between
the president and the
Ayatollah
Khomeini?
Well, remember, it's 30 years since the Shah fell. And you had 8 years of warfare against Iraq in which you never had a major incident between the army and the Revolutionary Guard. There is a tendency to think of this as if somehow the army was the army of, say, 1981. It isn't. The same is true of the Air Force and other services. Last year, when the Revolutionary Guards got control of operations in the Gulf, and the Navy was given control of operations in the Gulf of Oman and the Indian Ocean, we have no indication that there was any kind of dissent or any power. Your question about the difference between the leader and Ahmadinejad is something where experts do disagree, but certainly judging by the evidence in the last few months, Ahmadinejad and the leader have cooperated fairly solidly, and the leader has been willing to back Ahmadinejad in things like removing the coordinates, as well as raising at a different level figures which were formerly in the Islamic Revolutionary Guards to higher levels of power outside the more visible informal structure. What we really don't know is how much this visible leadership actually is real and how much of it actually resides in figures which are not visible within this power structure that is the IRGC and its alumni. What is noises in Iranian politics may not be a symbol of what is most popular. But we do know, just looking at the headcount, that the people in the IRGC keep acquiring new positions in the economy, not simply in the security space. That doesn't mean that this won't create resentment or tensions or differences. There are plenty of those in Iran. But I'd also have to say that having lived and worked in Iran, one has to be careful because this is a remarkably personal, factional country. I was told when I went to work with the Iranian military that I should always understand that you do not have a real superior. You spy on your superior for his superior. I thought at the time it was something of a joke. About 4 months later, it didn't seem to be very funny. And this is a different culture. It operates in different rules. Yes.
Sir, I apologize if I do advance my question, but knowing that or hearing what you said about difficulties and problems in the options and the implications of the Islamic Congress in the ongoing sanctions, and on the other hand, the Israelis insistence that some resolution should be drawn, I would like to get your view on what is the your prospects for real solutions if regime change cannot happen, military is back to that resolves the anxieties and every question that we have about Iran's nuclear program, and something that is workable and accepted in Washington.
Well, you haven't answered your question. First, you don't have solutions to history. That is something that those of us who live in Washington sometimes have in trouble. But my brother was a Marine in the Korean War, and I don't think we've solved that. We had to be at Vietnam, and the good news is the dominoes fell in our direction eventually. But we still have the problem with what happened there. Things have improved with Russia, but we haven't solved Russia. And you look at the problem with Iran, if we carried out this level of strikes I've just outlined, we could probably solve the missile and the nuclear problem. It would not necessarily mean we didn't get another round of fighting between Lebanon and Israel. If we did carry this out, we might find ourselves in constant low-level struggle with intimidation in the Gulf, and in Iran, which went from swarming and long-range missile strikes to do everything it could to deal with this capability. If we hit them at the overt nuclear level with what we know, we can never be sure that there will not be a P4, P5 complex underground or distributed what are called golden centers. You can make the situation better. How much better you can make it is something that requires a level of intelligence clearance, targeting, and capability analysis, which frankly is something that people outside the JCS can only speculate on. It's a different world when you sit here with unclassified data. But I'd be cautious. I don't believe that an Israeli strike would have a decisive result, even if it brought 2 to 3 years. I can't say it would make things worse or stimulate Iran into provocation, which would challenge Israel much more through proxies on its borders and find other ways to strike while Iran recovered. I would be very, I think, uncertain about what would happen if we carried out the major strike I talked about. What are the options for that? They don't solve things. They're containment. They're missile defense. They're a strong presence in the Gulf. We're doing what we can to build up a strategic partnership with Iraq and our Gulf allies, programs we already have underway. They are deploying the missile capabilities we need for missile defense. they're giving teeth to the phrase extended regional deterrence. All of those are options, but they basically contain and deter and act as means of limiting damage in worst cases. They don't solve history. And I frankly think barring something we can't predict, which is a truly radical restructuring of the Iranian regime and intentions, this is another case where we may have to live with this level of problem for several decades, which is what happens in major strategic confrontations more often than not.
Lieutenant Colonel Yeager, Middle East Studies. With Pakistan having a nuclear capacity, Iran working on it, wouldn't it be natural for Saudi Arabia at least, or some of the others, to gain knowledge and once a nuclear capacity as well?
Well, it might be possible that Saudi Arabia would do what it did with Chinese missiles, and why? The technology base here is far more complex than people seem to understand. Remember that Iran has been at this since the time of the Shah. It's sort of an esoteric piece of knowledge, but in an effort to deter the Shah's nuclear weapons program, the CIA actually issued a short, unclassified document listing the Shah's illegal arms imports. Getting a copy of that would at this point be, I think, an antique. But it happened. And even though Khomeini basically halted the program initially by 1984, the nuclear chemical issue had already restarted. We also have the problem here of biological weapons, and understand that no matter what we do with the nuclear, all of these countries that have a major industrial base, and that does include Saudi Arabia, will be able to basically produce genetically engineered biological weapons in the next 5 to 10 years, at least in theory. There's no indication for doing it. I think Saudi Arabia would actually prefer reliance on a credible extended range deterrent if it could be sure that the United States would use it, that the United States will keep up its support of all the Gulf states, that we are not going to, as we may do in the next week, back away from funding strategic partnership with Iraq, because that is a major issue in the current markup of the 2011 budget. But people in the Gulf would need to see that we have this option. We have to show that we are willing to exercise it, not just talk about it. And they also have to see that that would be something that responds to an Iranian threat that materializes and develops in ways where they do not have to suddenly confront Iran before they're dealing with a clear set of Iranian deployment capabilities. I think the problem we're talking about here is simply this. This isn't flipping a coin. This is three-dimensional chess. And you have to think of it that way. And you have to think of it with partners. And the partners are every southern Gulf state and hopefully Iraq. Well, thank you for the opportunity to come here and cheer you all up.
Just a quick note. First of all, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to all of you. We won't see you until next year. But on 11 January, same time, 1400, we have Michael Eisenstadt from the Washington Institute in Washington, and his title is Iran's Strategic Culture, Patterns, and Paradoxes. So again, 1400, is it? It will be at GRC, not here, but at the GRC. Those of you who are on the distribution list will receive the notifications from our office, from Adam. Those of you who are not and wish to be, please see Adam's sites right in the corner there, and we will get you that. Dr. Kodesman's entire slide will be on our website, plus we will have the DVD of this talk over there, and all of these talks eventually will become a collected a volume which we published in by Lincoln University Press, hopefully sometime next year. Thank you very much for attending. Thank you, Dr.